Hello, and welcome to Family Folktales from the Nashville Public Library. I'm Susan Poulter, a librarian at the Main Library. Today I'll be reading the conclusion of The Story of Two Sisters Who Were Jealous of Their Younger Sister. This is the 16th and final part of our stories from The Arabian Nights Entertainments, selected and edited by Andrew Lang. As may be imagined, Prince Perviz and his sister were all this time in the greatest anxiety and consulted the magic knife not once, but many times a day. Hitherto, the blade had remained bright and spotless, but on the fatal hour on which Prince Bahman and his horse were changed into black stones, large drops of blood appeared on the surface. "Ah, my beloved brother," cried the princess in horror, throwing the knife from her. "I shall never see you again, and it is I who have killed you. Fool that I was to listen to the voice of that temptress, who probably was not speaking the truth. What are the talking bird and the singing tree to me, in comparison with you, passionately though I long for them?" Prince Perviz's grief at his brother's loss was not less than that of Princess Parizade, but he did not waste his time on useless lamentations. "My sister," he said, "why should you think that the old woman was deceiving you about these treasures? And what would have been her object in doing so? No, our brother must have met his death by some accident or want of precaution, and tomorrow I will start on the same quest." Terrified at the thought that she might lose her only remaining brother, the princess entreated him to give up his project, but he remained firm. Before setting out, however, he gave her a chaplet of 100 pearls and said, "When I am absent, tell this over daily for me. But if you should find that the beads stick so they will not slip one after the other, you will know that my brother's fate has befallen me. Still, we must hope for better luck." Then he departed, and on the 20th day of his journey fell in with the dervish on the same spot as Prince Bahman had met him, and began to question him as to the place where the talking bird, the singing tree, and the golden water were to be found. As in the case of his brother, the dervish tried to make him give up his project, and even told him that only a few weeks since a man bearing a strong resemblance to himself had passed that way, but had never come back again. "That, holy dervish," replied Prince Perviz, "was my elder brother, who is now dead, though how he died I cannot say." "He is changed into a black stone," answered the dervish, "like all the rest who have gone on the same errand, and you will become one likewise if you are not more careful in following my directions." Then he charged the prince, as he valued his life, to take no heed of the clamor of voices that would pursue him up the mountain, and handing him a ball from the bag, which still seemed to be half full, he sent him on his way. When Prince Perviz reached the foot of the mountain, he jumped from his horse and paused for a moment to recall the instructions the dervish had given him. Then he strode boldly on, but had scarcely gone 5 or 6 paces when he was startled by a man's voice that seemed close to his ear, exclaiming, "Stop, rash fellow, and let me punish your audacity." This outrage entirely put the dervish's advice out of the prince's head. He drew his sword and turned to avenge himself, but almost before he had realized that there was nobody there, he and his horse were 2 black stones. Not a morning had passed since Prince Perviz had ridden away without Princess Parizade telling her beads, and at night she even hung them round her neck so that if she woke, she could assure herself at once of her brother's safety. She was in the very act of moving them through her fingers at the moment that the prince fell victim to his impatience, and her heart sank when the first pearl remained fixed in its place. However, she had long made up her mind what she would do in such a case, and the following morning the princess, disguised as a man, set out for the mountain. As she had been accustomed to riding from her childhood, she managed to travel as many miles daily as her brothers had done, and it was, as before, on the 20th day that she arrived at the place where the dervish was sitting. "Good dervish," she said politely, "will you allow me to rest by you for a few moments? And perhaps you'll be so kind as to tell me if you have ever heard of a talking bird, a singing tree, and some golden water that are to be found somewhere near this?" "Madam," replied the dervish, "for in spite of your manly dress your voice betrays you, I shall be proud to serve you in any way I can. But may I ask the purpose of your question?" "Good dervish," answered the princess, "I have heard such glowing descriptions of these three things that I cannot rest till I possess them." "Madam," said the dervish, "they are far more beautiful than any description. But you seem ignorant of all the difficulties that stand in your way, or you would hardly have undertaken such an adventure. Give it up, I pray you, and return home, and do not ask me to help you to a cruel death." "Holy Father," answered the princess, "I come from far, and I should be in despair if I turned back without having attained my object. You have spoken of difficulties. Tell me, I entreat you, what they are, so that I may know if I can overcome them, or see if they are beyond my strength." So the dervish repeated his tale, and dwelt more firmly than before on the clamor of the voices, the horrors of the black stones, which were once living men, and the difficulties of climbing the mountain, and pointed out that the chief means of success was never to look behind till you had the cage in your grasp. "As far as I can see," said the princess, "the first thing is not to mind the tumult of voices that follow you till you reach the cage, and then never to look behind. As to this, I think I have enough self-control to look straight before me. But as it is quite possible that I might be frightened by the voices, as even the boldest men have been, I will stop up my ears with cotton, so that, let them make as much noise as they like, I shall hear nothing." "Madam," cried the dervish, "out of all the number who have asked me the way to the mountain, you are the first who has ever suggested such a means of escaping the danger. It is possible that you may succeed, but all the same the risk is great." "Good dervish," answered the princess, "I feel in my heart that I shall succeed, and it only remains for me to ask you the way I am to go." Then the dervish said that it was useless to say more, and he gave her the ball, which she flung before her. The first thing the princess did on arriving at the mountain was to stop her ears with cotton, and then, making up her mind which was the best way to go, she began her ascent. In spite of the cotton, some echoes of the voices reached her ears, but not so as to trouble her. Indeed, though they grew louder and more insulting the higher she climbed, the princess only laughed and said to herself that she certainly would not let a few rough words stand between her and the goal. At last she perceived in the distance the cage and the bird, whose voice joined itself in tones of thunder to those of the rest. "Return! Return! Never dare to come near me!" At the sight of the bird, the princess hastened her steps, and without vexing herself at the noise, which by this time had grown deafening, she walked straight up to the cage, and seizing it, she said, "Now, my bird, I have got you, and I shall take good care that you do not escape." As she spoke, she took the cotton from her ears, for it was needed no longer. "Brave lady," answered the bird, "do not blame me for having joined my voice to those who did their best to preserve my freedom. Although confined in a cage, I was content with my lot. But if I must become a slave, I could not wish for a nobler mistress than one who has shown so much constancy. And from this moment I swear to serve you faithfully. Some day you will put me to the proof, for I know who you are better than you do yourself. Meanwhile, tell me what I can do, and I will obey you." "Bird," replied the princess, who was filled with a joy that seemed strange to herself when she thought that the bird had cost her the lives of both of her brothers, "bird, let me first thank you for your good will. And then let me ask you where the golden water is to be found." The bird described the place, which was not far distant, and the princess filled a small silver flask that she had brought with her for the purpose. She then returned to the cage and said, "Bird, there is still something else. Where shall I find the singing tree?" "Behind you, in that wood," replied the bird, and the princess wandered through the wood till a sound of the sweetest voices told her she had found what she sought. But the tree was tall and strong, and it was hopeless to think of uprooting it. "You need not do that," said the bird, when she had returned to ask counsel. "Break off a twig and plant it in your garden, and it will take root and grow into a magnificent tree." When the Princess Parizade held in her hands the three wonders promised her by the old woman, she said to the bird, "All that is not enough. It was owing to you that my brothers became black stones. I cannot tell them from the mass of others, but you must know, and point them out to me, I beg you, for I wish to carry them away." For some reason that the princess could not guess, these words seemed to displease the bird, and he did not answer. The princess waited a moment, and then continued in severe tones, "Have you forgotten that you yourself said that you are my slave to do my bidding, and also that your life is in my power?" "No, I have not forgotten," replied the bird. "But what you ask is very difficult. However, I will do my best." "If you look around," he went on, "you will see a pitcher standing near. Take it, and as you go down the mountain, scatter a little of the water it contains over every black stone, and you will soon find your two brothers." Princess Parizade took the pitcher, and carrying with her besides the cage the twig and the flask, and returned down the side of the mountain. At every black stone she stopped and sprinkled it with water, and as the water touched it, the stone instantly became a man. When she suddenly saw her brothers before her, her delight was mixed with astonishment. What are you doing here?" she cried. "We've been asleep," they said. "Yes," returned the princess, "but without me your sleep would probably have lasted till the day of judgment. Have you forgotten that you came here in search of the talking bird, the singing tree, and the golden water, and the black stones that were heaped up along the road? Look round and see if there is one left. These gentlemen and yourselves and all your horses were changed into these stones, and I have delivered you by sprinkling you with the water from this pitcher. As I could not return home without you, even though I had gained the prizes on which I had set my heart, I forced the talking bird to tell me how to break the spell." On hearing these words, Prince Bahman and Prince Perviz understood all they owed their sister, and the knights who stood by declared themselves her slaves and ready to carry out her wishes. But the princess, while thanking them for their politeness, explained that she wished for no company but that of her brothers, and that the rest were free to go where they would. So saying, the princess mounted her horse, and, declining to allow even Prince Bahman to carry the cage with the talking bird, she entrusted him with the branch of the singing tree, while Prince Perviz took care of the flask containing the golden water. Then they rode away, followed by the knights and gentlemen, who begged to be permitted to escort them. It had been the intention of the party to stop and tell their adventures to the dervish, but they found to their sorrow that he was dead, whether from old age or whether from the feeling that his task was done, they never knew. As they continued their road, their numbers grew daily smaller, for the knights turned off one by one to their own homes, and only the brothers and sister finally drew up at the gate of the palace. The princess carried the cage straight into the garden, and as soon as the bird began to sing, nightingales, larks, thrushes, finches, and all sorts of other birds mingled their voices in chorus. The branch she planted in a corner near the house, and in a few days it had grown into a great tree. As for the golden water, it was poured into a great marble basin specially prepared for it, and it swelled and bubbled and then shot up into the air in a fountain 20 feet high. The fame of these wonders soon spread abroad, and people came from far and near to see and admire. After a few days, Prince Bahman and Prince Perviz fell back into their ordinary way of life and passed most of their time hunting. One day it happened that the Sultan of Persia was also hunting in the same direction, and not wishing to interfere with his sport, the young men, on hearing the noise of the hunt approaching, prepared to retire. But, as luck would have it, they turned into the very path down which the Sultan was coming. They threw themselves from their horses and prostrated themselves to the earth. But the Sultan was curious to see their faces and commanded them to rise. The princes stood up respectfully, but quite at their ease, and the Sultan looked at them for a few moments without speaking. Then he asked who they were and where they lived. "Sire," replied Prince Bahman, "we are sons of your Highness's late intendant of the gardens, and we live in a house that he built a short time before his death, waiting till an occasion should offer itself to serve your Highness."
"You seem fond of hunting," answered the Sultan.
"Sire," replied Prince Bahman, "it is our usual exercise, and one that should be neglected by no man who expects to comply with the ancient customs of the kingdom and bear arms." The Sultan was delighted with this remark, and said at once, "In that case, I shall take great pleasure in watching you. Come, choose what sort of beasts you would like to hunt." The princes jumped on their horses and followed the Sultan at a little distance. They'd not gone very far before they saw a number of wild animals appear at once, and Prince Bahman started to give chase to a lion and Prince Perviz to a bear. Both used their javelins with such skill that directly they arrived within striking range, the lion and the bear fell, pierced through and through. Then Prince Perviz pursued a lion and Prince Bahman a bear, and in a very few minutes they too lay dead. As they were making ready for a third assault, the Sultan interfered, and sending one of his officials to summon them, he said, smiling, "If I let you go on, there'll soon be no beasts left to hunt. Besides, your courage and manners have so won my heart that I will not have you expose yourselves to further danger. I am convinced that some day or other I shall find you useful as well as agreeable." He then gave them a warm invitation to stay with him altogether, but with many thanks for the honor done them, they begged to be excused and to be suffered to remain at home. The Sultan, who was not accustomed to see his offers rejected, inquired their reasons, and Prince Bahman explained that they did not wish to leave their sister, and were accustomed to do nothing without consulting all three together. "Ask her advice, then," replied the Sultan, "and tomorrow come and hunt with me and give me your answer." The two princes returned home, but their adventure made so little impression on them that they quite forgot to speak to their sister on the subject. The next morning, when they went to hunt, they met the Sultan in the same place, and he inquired what advice their sister had given. The young men looked at each other and blushed. At last Prince Bahman said, "Sire, we must throw ourselves on your Highness's mercy. Neither my brother nor myself remembered anything about it." "Then be sure you do not forget today," answered the Sultan, "and bring me back your reply tomorrow." When, however, the same thing happened a second time, they feared the Sultan might be angry with them for their carelessness. But he took it in good part, and drawing three little golden balls from his purse, he held them out to Prince Bahman, saying, "Put these in your bosom, and you will not forget a third time, for when you remove your girdle tonight, the noise they will make in falling will remind you of my wishes." It all happened as the Sultan had foreseen, and the two brothers appeared in their sister's apartments just as she was in the act of stepping into bed, and told their tale. The Princess Parizade was much disturbed at the news, and did not conceal her feelings. "Your meeting with the Sultan is very honorable to you," she said, "and will, I dare say, be of service to you, but it places me in a very awkward position. It is on my account I know that you have resisted the Sultan's wishes, and I'm very grateful to you for it. But kings do not like to have their offers refused, and in time he would bear a grudge against you, which would render me very unhappy. Consult the talking bird, who is wise and far-seeing, and let me hear what he says." So the bird was sent for, and the case laid before him.
The princes must on no account refuse the Sultan's proposal, said he, and they must even invite him to come and see your house. But Bird, objected the princess, you know how dearly we love each other. Will not all this spoil our friendship? Not at all, replied the bird. It will make it closer. Then the Sultan will have to see me, said the princess. The bird answered that it was necessary that he should see her, and everything would turn out for the best. The following morning, when the Sultan inquired if they had spoken to their sister and what advice she had given them, Prince Bahman replied that they were ready to agree to His Highness's wishes, and that their sister had reproved them for their hesitation about the matter. The Sultan received their excuses with great kindness and told them that he was sure they would be equally faithful to him and kept them by his side for the rest of the day, to the vexation of the Grand Vizier and the rest of the court. When the procession entered in this order the gates of the capital, the eyes of the people who crowded the streets were fixed on the two young men, strangers to everyone. Oh, if only the Sultan had sons that looked like that, they murmured. They look so distinguished, and are about the same age that his sons would have been. The Sultan commanded that splendid apartments should be prepared for the two brothers, and even insisted that they should sit at table with him. During dinner, he led the conversation to various scientific subjects, and also to history, of which he was especially fond. But whatever topic they might be discussing, he found that the views of the young men were always worth listening to. If they were my own sons, he said to himself, they could not be better educated. And aloud, he complimented them on their learning and taste for knowledge. At the end of the evening, the princes once more prostrated themselves before the throne and asked leave to return home. And then, encouraged by the gracious words of farewell uttered by the Sultan, Prince Bahman said, Sire, may we dare to take the liberty of asking whether you would do us and our sister the honor of resting a few minutes at our house the first time the hunt passes that way? With the utmost pleasure, replied the Sultan, and as I am all impatience to see the sister of such accomplished young men, you may expect me the day after tomorrow. The princess was, of course, most anxious to entertain the Sultan in a fitting way, but as she had no experience in court customs, she ran to the talking bird and begged he would advise her as to what dishes should be served. My dear mistress, replied the bird, your cooks are very good, and you can safely leave all to them, except that you must be careful to have a dish of cucumbers, stuffed with pearl sauce, served with the very first course. "Cucumbers stuffed with pearls!" exclaimed the princess. "Why, bird, who ever heard of such a dish? The Sultan will expect a dinner he can eat, and not one he can only admire. Besides, if I were to use all the pearls I possess, they would not be half enough." "Mistress," replied the bird, "do what I tell you, and nothing but good will come of it. And as to the pearls, if you go at dawn tomorrow, and dig at the foot of the first tree in the park on the right hand, you will find as many as you want." The princess had faith in the bird, who generally proved to be right, and taking the gardener with her early next morning, followed out his directions carefully. After digging for some time, they came upon a golden box fastened with little clasps. These were easily undone, and the box was found to be full of pearls, not very large ones, but well-shaped and of a good color. So, leaving the gardener to fill up the hole he had made under the tree, the princess took up the box and returned to the house. The two princes had seen her go out and had wondered what could have made her rise so early. Full of curiosity, they got up and dressed and met their sister as she was returning with the box under her arm. "What have you been doing?" they asked. "And did the gardener come to tell you he had found a treasure?" "On the contrary," replied the princess, "it is I who have found one." And opening the box, she showed her astonished brothers the pearls inside. Then, on the way back to the palace, she told them of her consultation with the bird and the advice it had given her. All three tried to guess the meaning of the singular counsel, but they were forced at last to admit the explanation was beyond them, and they must be content blindly to obey. The first thing the princess did on entering the palace was to send for the head cook and to order the repast for the sultan. When she had finished, she suddenly added, "Besides the dishes I have mentioned, there is one that you must prepare expressly for the sultan, and that no one must touch but yourself. It consists of a stuffed cucumber, and the stuffing is to be made of these pearls." The head cook, who had never in all his experience heard of such a dish, stepped back in amazement. "You think I am mad," answered the princess, who perceived what was in his mind. "But I know quite well what I am doing. Go and do your best, and take the pearls with you." The next morning the princes started for the forest and were soon joined by the sultan. The hunt began and continued until midday, when the heat became so great that they were obliged to leave off. Then, as arranged, they turned their horses' heads towards the palace, and while Prince Bahman remained by the side of the sultan, Prince Perviz rode on to warn his sister of their approach. The moment His Highness entered the courtyard, the princess flung herself at his feet, but he bent and raised her and gazed at her for some time, struck with her grace and beauty, and also with the indefinable air of courts that seemed to hang around this country girl. "They are all worthy one of the other," he said to himself, "and I am not surprised that they think so much of her opinions. I must know more of them." By this time the princess had recovered from the first embarrassment of meeting and proceeded to make her speech of welcome. "This is only a simple country house, sire," she said, "suitable to people like ourselves who live a quiet life. It cannot compare with the great city mansions, much less, of course, with the smallest of the sultan's palaces." "I cannot quite agree with you," he replied. "Even the little that I have seen I admire greatly, and I will reserve my judgment until you have shown me the whole." The princess then led the way from room to room, and the sultan examined everything carefully. "Do you call this a simple country house?" he said at last. "Why, if every country house was like this, the towns would soon be deserted. I am no longer astonished that you do not wish to leave it. Let us go into the gardens, which I am sure are no less beautiful than the rooms." A small door opened straight into the garden, and the first object that met the sultan's eyes was the golden water. "What lovely colored water!" he exclaimed. "Where is the spring, and how do you make the fountain rise so high? I do not believe there is anything like it in the world." He went forward to examine it, and when he had satisfied his curiosity, the princess conducted him towards the singing tree. As they drew near, the sultan was startled by the sound of strange voices, but could see nothing. "Where have you hidden your musicians?" he asked the princess. "Are they up in the air or under the earth? Surely the owners of such charming voices ought not to conceal themselves." "Sire," answered the princess, "the voices all come from the tree, which is straight in front of us. And if you will deign to advance a few steps, you will see that they become clearer." The sultan did as he was told, and was so rapt in delight at what he heard that he stood some time in silence. "Tell me, madam, I pray you," he said at last, "how this marvelous tree came into your garden. It must have been brought from a great distance, or else, fond as I am of all curiosities, I could not have missed hearing of it. What is its name?" "The only name it has, sire," replied she, "is the singing tree, and it is not a native of this country. Its history is mixed up with those of the golden water and the talking bird, which you have not yet seen. If your highness wishes, I will tell you the whole story when you have recovered from your fatigue." "Indeed, madam," returned he, "you show me so many wonders that it is impossible to feel any fatigue. Let us go once more and look at the golden water, and I am dying to see the talking bird." The sultan could hardly tear himself away from the golden water, which puzzled him more and more. "You say," he observed to the princess, "that this water does not come from any spring, neither is it brought by pipes. All I understand is that neither it nor the singing tree is a native of this country.
It is as you say, sire, answered the princess, and if you examine the basin, you will see that it is all in one piece. Therefore, the water could not have been brought through it. What is more astonishing is that I only emptied a small flaskful into the basin, and it increased to the quantity you now see.
Well, I will look at it no more today, said the Sultan. Take me to the talking bird.
On approaching the house, the Sultan noticed a vast quantity of birds whose voices filled the air, and he inquired why they were so much more numerous here than in any other part of the garden.
Sire, answered the princess, do you see that cage hanging in one of the windows of the saloon? That is the talking bird, whose voice you can hear above them all, even above that of the nightingale. And the birds crowd to this spot to add their songs to his.
The Sultan stepped through the window, but the bird took no notice, continuing his song as before.
My slave, said the princess, this is the Sultan. Make him a pretty speech.
The bird stopped singing at once, and all the other birds stopped too.
The Sultan is welcome, he said. I wish him long life and all prosperity.
I thank you, good bird, answered the Sultan, seating himself before the repast, which was spread at a table near the window. And I am enchanted to see in you the Sultan and King of the Birds.
The Sultan, noticing that his favorite dish of cucumber was placed before him, proceeded to help himself to it, and was amazed to find that the stuffing was of pearls.
A novelty indeed, cried he, but I do not understand the reason of it. One cannot eat pearls.
Sire, replied the bird, before either the princes or the princess could speak, surely your highness cannot be so surprised at beholding a cucumber stuffed with pearls, when you believed without any difficulty that the Sultana had presented you, instead of children, with a dog, a cat, and a log of wood.
I believed it, answered the Sultan, because the women attending on her told me so.
The women, sire, said the bird, were the sisters of the Sultana, who were devoured with jealousy at the honor you had done her, and in order to revenge themselves invented this story. Have them examined, and they will confess their crime. These are your children, who were saved from death by the intendant of your gardens, and brought up by him as if they were his own.
Like a flash, the truth came to the mind of the Sultan.
Bird, he cried, my heart tells me that what you say is true. My children, he added, let me embrace you and embrace each other, not only as brothers and sister, but as having in you the blood royal of Persia, which could flow in no nobler veins.
When the first moments of emotion were over, the Sultan hastened to finish his repast, and then turning to his children, he exclaimed, "Today you have made acquaintance with your father. Tomorrow I will bring you the Sultana, your mother. Be ready to receive her." The Sultan then mounted his horse and rode quickly back to the capital. Without an instant's delay, he sent for the Grand Vizier and ordered him to seize and question the Sultana's sisters that very day.
This was done.
They were confronted with each other and proved guilty and were executed in less than an hour. But the Sultan did not wait to hear that his orders had been carried out before going on foot, followed by his whole court, to the door of the great mosque, and drawing the Sultana with his own hand out of the narrow prison where she had spent so many years.
"Madam," he cried, embracing her with tears in his eyes, "I have come to ask your pardon for the injustice I have done to you, and to repair it as far as I may. I have already begun by punishing the authors of this abominable crime, and I hope you will forgive me when I introduce you to our children, who are the most charming and accomplished creatures in the whole world. Come with me and take back your position and all the honor that is due you."
This speech was delivered in the presence of a vast multitude of people who had gathered from all parts on the first hint of what was happening, and the news was passed from mouth to mouth in a few seconds. Early next day, the Sultan and Sultana, dressed in robes of state and followed by all the court, set out for the country house of their children. Here the Sultan presented them to the Sultana one by one, and for some time there was nothing but embraces and tears and tender words. Then they ate of the magnificent dinner which had been prepared for them, and after they were all refreshed, they went into the garden, where the Sultan pointed out to his wife the golden water and the singing tree. As to the talking bird, she had already made acquaintance with him. In the evening they rode together back to the capital, the princes on each side of their father, and the princess with her mother. Long before they reached the gates, the way was lined with people, and the air filled with shouts of welcome, with which were mingled the songs of the talking bird, sitting in its cage on the lap of the princess, and of the birds who followed it. And in this manner they came back to their father's palace. That was the conclusion of The Story of Two Sisters Who Were Jealous of Their Younger Sister, from the Arabian Nights Entertainments, selected and edited by Andrew Lang. Special thanks to Ginger Sands for our theme music. You can find more of Ginger's music at iTunes or on her website at www.gingersands.com. And if you'd like to comment on today's story, send me an email. I can be reached at susan.poulter, that's P-O-U-L-T-E-R, @nashville.gov. Thanks for listening.